Well, good morning. I appreciate the congregation hosting it, this meeting. I think it was in 2005 when you were hosting the two-week meeting that Rick stood up here and mentioned at the end of the meeting that this congregation had hosted the two-week meeting more than any other congregation. I don't know if that's still true, but Gregory, you've done a lot for us down through the years, and I appreciate you being willing to hold one of these, and I thank you for the opportunity to be a part of it. If you've looked at the program, you know, and I'm feeling a little sheepish about this, but you know that I have been asked to address young marrieds, parenting, child rearing, and men's role in the family. And can I get a show of hands of how many of you still have children at home? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. All right. How many of you have children under the age of 12 at home? All right. Well, that encourages me a little bit here, so I don't feel like I'm just talking to people who don't care a hoot about it or are past it. But those subjects, my focus is supposed to be on the godly man as a family man, as a husband and father. And that's just how I've divided it up. If you look at what we're going to be talking about today during my time, it's being a godly husband and then transitioning then to being a godly father. And I think we need to start with being a godly husband because, as it has been so rightfully said before, the focus of the family should always be on the relationship that started it. Those of you with many more years experience than me know the truth of this, that if we will love our wives, everything else will fall into place, largely. The greatest thing a father can do for his children is to love their wife. We've heard that, but I am more and more coming to appreciate the truth of that. A man who does not show the affection to his wife, the love for his wife that he should, finds not only their marriage being strained, if not worse, but he sees the same thing happening to his family in general. So it's good for us to think about being godly husbands. And let's just begin in the beginning. In the beginning, Bible tells us God created the heavens and the earth. And we know that when the sixth day dawned, and of course that's not when the day began, but when the day began, on the sixth day, God had made heaven and earth and nearly all that is in them. What was left to be made when the sixth day arrived? Beast and man. God had made the heavens to declare His glory. He had made the firmament to show His handiwork. His invisible attributes were ready to be understood by the things that He had made, but there was as yet no one to understand them. God's creation was good, but it was incomplete. It was not yet very good. So Genesis chapter 2, verse 7 tells us words we're very familiar with. The Lord God formed man out of the dust of the ground, breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and man became a living being. And on the sixth day, mankind was brought into existence. And like the rest of creation, man was good. God made man upright. They have sought out many schemes. Ecclesiastes 7:29. Man was good, but he was incomplete. What did God say about man when he looked down on the man? He wasn't surprised about this. He wasn't learning anything, but he was declaring it for our good. When God looked down on Adam, what did he say? Yes. Genesis 2:18, Lord God said, "It is not good. It is not good that man should be alone. I will make him a helper comparable to him." It's not good. Do you believe that this morning? It's not good. God caused that deep sleep to fall on Adam. He drew from Adam's side that rib, and it appears he drew some flesh with it. He closes up the flesh, makes from that rib a woman. He brings that woman to Adam, and what did Adam say when he saw her? "This is now bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh." That's what leads me to believe there must have been some flesh involved. "This is now bone of my bone, flesh of my flesh. She shall be called woman because she was taken out of man. She shall be called Isha because she was taken out of Ish," says the Hebrew. And the Genesis writer goes on to tell us, "Therefore, in light of this now, a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. He shall leave and cleave." And there's a powerful lesson and point to be made here, which we've already made, and that is that you need, or at the very least, are much better off with your wife than you would be without her. I need my wife if I'm going to be all I can be, if I'm going to be what God wants me to be. Be you a young man, an older man, or an older man, one of the first things that every man needs to remember is that he needs his wife. "Oh, I could get by without her." Well, maybe. Maybe you could exist without her. But you would not be what you could be. You are happier with her. You are better with her than you would be without her. God has said it is not good that you should be alone. And when you married her, you knew that. When you married her, you knew that. You didn't marry her because you could live with her. You married her because you didn't think you could live without her. You wanted her to be in your life. You believed Proverbs 18:22 that he who finds a wife finds what? A good thing and obtains favor from the Lord. I look at, when I think of Amber, I see how true this is. Amber is one of the greatest blessings God has ever given me. How many times down through the years has her counsel spared me? Her wisdom guided me. Her personal sacrifices benefited me. She has saved me 1,000 times over from my own foolishness and has helped me see things I never would have seen before and has helped me, allowed us to provide things for our children we never would have been able to provide before. Many of us have seen down through the years how a woman has made a man. Can you think of an instance where you've seen that? Where a young man who seems like maybe he's a little bit listless or he's a little bit wishy-washy or seems to be having trouble finding direction, lacks confidence, and then he marries the right woman and what happens? It doesn't happen overnight, but over time suddenly we see this man having confidence. We see him taking responsibility. We see him being something he never would have been without her. Now it works the other way too. A woman can break a man, but a good, godly woman is of inestimable value to a man. But sometimes men forget it. In fact, many a man forgets it. Bill McCartney, founder of Promise Keepers, and I do not endorse Promise Keepers, but it's an organization with which we're all familiar. He tells the story of how there was one statement he heard from a pulpit while he was still coaching football at the University of Colorado that changed the course of his life. And that statement was the following. If you want to measure the worth of a man's effectiveness in life. Hear that words, those words again, if you will. If you want to measure the worth of a man's effectiveness in life, all you have to do is look on the countenance of his wife. Mr. McCartney says, after hearing that, he looked at his wife, Lindy, and was crushed by the sadness and the pain that he saw in her eyes. What do you see when you look at your wife? What do others see when they look at her? Do you see a woman who is secure in your love, is content and rejoicing and being all that she can be? Or do you see a woman who is sad and forlorn, maybe angry and bitter and empty? The happiness of my wife is a fair barometer, not the only barometer, but it is a fair barometer of just how good a job I am doing at being the man I'm supposed to be. If you have the kind of wife that Bill McCartney says he has, I know you know this, but that's not the way it ought to be. Proverbs 5:18 says, "Let your fountain be blessed and rejoice with the wife of your youth." This is what God wants. He wants me to be rejoicing with my wife and she with me. God has made marriage to make men and women better, happier, and too many homes aren't like that. How many of you here have had the experience of being in a Christian home and you could tell, even though nothing was ever outright said, you could tell that that marriage was an unhappy one? How many of us have had that experience? I have had that experience. I travel around, I've stayed in those homes, and you can stay in some of those homes year after year and things never get any better. You have a man and a woman who've maybe been in the church for years, and they're just living parallel lives in the same house, and rarely do the twain meet. And the wives, these precious blessings from God, these ones who the man just felt he couldn't live without so many years ago. This weaker vessel who's been given into his care, she just simply plods through life day after day. She's sad, she's empty, and yeah, by now she's a little bitter and angry. She endures a lonely, unloved existence that she didn't sign up for when she said, "I do." We have a huge burden of responsibility. God gives these women into our care. They are weaker. They are more vulnerable. God gives them into our care and they depend on us. They come to us yearning for security and counting on us for it. And then sometimes we have just left them without all that they desperately needed. And now they're trapped inside this house with a man they really didn't want to marry or didn't know they were marrying. It's not God's plan for those women. It's not God's plan for us. If you are married, writes Michael Pearl, if you are married but do not function as one with your wife, you are still alone. The aloneness also is worse than it was when you were single, because then you had great expectations of fulfillment. But your relationship now mocks you. For you are like a thirsty man who spent his last dollar to buy a well, only to discover that the water is too bitter to drink. You're in this home, in this relationship with the woman who was to be your soulmate. And there's emptiness there. I don't know if any of you find yourself in that situation today. Maybe you don't, in which case some of what I'm saying is just going to seem unnecessary. But if you do find yourself in a situation like that, or at the very least you know that your relationship with your wife is not what it could be and should be, I first of all want you to remember how valuable she is. I want you to remember from where you have fallen and look back to the wonderful thing you saw in her. And I want you to know also that the bitter waters of the well you find yourself drinking from right now can be healed. Bitter and broken hearts can be fixed. And that sweet, joyful, adoring girl you married all those years ago or several years ago, you can have again. In fact, you can have a marriage better than you've ever had before. You can have a relationship like you've never guessed. But it's going to take action on your part. You're going to have to be the solution. The cure is not new, it's not complicated, and it's if she's been willing to stay in the same house with you up until this time, it's almost sure to succeed. And it's just one word. Anybody want to tell me what it is? It's love. Oh, I thought you were going to give me something better than that, John. It's love. Let's take a look at Ephesians 5, even though I know we're familiar with that passage already. Let's just examine it for a moment. Ephesians chapter 5. And we're not going to read what he says to the wives. We're going to read what he says to the husbands. Ephesians 5, beginning in verse 25. Husbands, love your wives, just as Christ also loved the church and gave himself for her, verse 26, that he might sanctify and cleanse her with the washing of water by the word, that he might present her to himself a glorious church, not having spot or wrinkle or any such thing, but that she should be holy and without blemish. So husbands ought to love their own wives as their own bodies. He who loves his wife loves himself, for no one ever hated his own flesh, but nourishes and cherishes it just as the Lord does the church, for we are members of his body, of his flesh, and of his bones. For this reason, a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. This is a great mystery, but I speak concerning Christ and the church. Nevertheless, let each one of you in particular so love his own wife as himself, and let the wife see that she respect her husband. God's number one command for husbands in Scripture is love your wives. We could have read verses 22 through 24 where he speaks to women and he calls them to submit to their own husbands. But is it not interesting? 22 through 24 tells women to submit to their husbands, and it's mentioned again down there at the end. And yet we've got this huge chunk of verses written to the men. Paul spends twice as many words talking about my responsibility to love my wife as he does of her responsibility to submit to me. The onus is on me. If my marriage is going to be better, if I'm going to have that sweet, loving woman that I married all those years ago back in my home, it's up to me to make it happen. So Paul says, love her. Can someone define love for me? And I'm speaking of this in the context of a troubled marriage, but even if your marriage is not troubled, making a better marriage, improving it, and seeing all the beauty that comes with it, it's still going to happen as a result of this. Someone define love for me. Yes, Neil. I was asked when I first came in to make sure I repeated some of this for the recording, so I'm going to try not to overdo it. But if you didn't hear it, and for the sake of the recording, love is something that is done. It's an action word, and we as workers have the ability to do that and reap the results. There was another hand over here. Was it you, Joseph? Joseph says a big part of it is not being selfish. Brett. Amen. All right. Self-sacrifice for the benefit of another, which those two things go hand in hand. R.C. Trench, in breaking down this Greek word, and the verb form is here, not that most of you probably care about it, but some of you might actually be interested. What's the form of love here that Paul's talking about? What's the Greek word behind it? Agape. Agape. That's actually the noun version of it. The verb form is right here. Agapao. That is to love. And R.C. Trench, in his work, mentions that this word specifically speaks to an intellectual attachment of choice and selection. Now, not necessarily that that's all it is, but it is a love of choice. That I can love my wife even when she's unlovable. Oh, John, but you don't understand my wife. You have not seen her. She comes to church and she's got her good face on. I'm not calling her a hypocrite, John, but you don't know what it's like in my home. When she gets angry, you don't know how things have gotten over the years in our relationship. Well, I may not. Let me ask you, though, if she is bitter and ugly or just unhappy and despondent and depressed, let me ask you, how did she get there? I am fully persuaded that in almost all cases, if a husband will love, as we have just heard it expressed, as he should, his wife will respond. And she won't be the kind of woman we hear men complaining about. Often it's just the men who are responsible for it. But regardless of whether or not she's lovable, her lovability has nothing to do with my responsibility. In the best of times and the worst of times, I am called to love her, even when she's hard to love. And a woman by the name of Liza Turkhurst, in her book Capture Her Heart, writes the following. That when a wife is hardest to love, chances are this is when she needs it most. She writes that by the time I am emotionally needy, this is a woman writing, I am usually hard to love. And she isn't speaking here of something deep-seated, but she's talking about just the normal ups and downs that will happen in a marriage. And she says the following. She says that as a man needs a woman sexually, so a woman needs a man emotionally. She writes, think about how you, writing to men, think about how you feel when it has been too long since you and your wife connected sexually. This is how she feels. When it has been too long since the two of you have connected emotionally. She'll be cranky. She'll be hard to love. But this is when she needs your love the most. I think there's a huge amount of truth in that. Love her as Christ also loved the church and gave himself for her. Well, I'd lay my life down for my wife. Okay, if you're willing to do that, then lay some time aside for her now. I married a couple. I don't know how long their marriage lasted, but it didn't last very long, maybe 6 months or something. And he was reputed to have said to some of the family he married into one day when one woman was visiting, he said, oh, I'm selfish or I'm self-centered. Well, he sure was. And that was a big problem, I'm sure, in their marriage. Self-centeredness will kill a marriage. You know, God made us to be God-centered, not self-centered, but God-centered and other-centered. And to be otherwise is to be off-center. And it has huge ramifications in a marriage. If I love my wife, she's going to come before my hobby. She's going to come before TV. She's going to come before my friends. She's going to come even before my work. She is going to take center stage just to the right of my obligations before God. Paul says, I'm going to love her as my own body. I married her and became one with her. Therefore, to love her is to love my own body. I'm going to nourish and cherish her. All that I would do for myself and more, I'm going to do for her. 1 Peter chapter 3. Let's go over there for a moment. We've read what the apostle to the Gentiles has to say, the apostle to the Jews. 1 Peter chapter 3. Speaking in context of the marriage relationship. Says the following to husbands, 1 Peter 3, verse 7, husbands, likewise dwell with them, that is, with your wives, with understanding, giving honor to the wife as to the weaker vessel and as being heirs together of the grace of life, that your prayers may not be hindered. 1 Peter 3, verse 7, dwell with them with understanding, or as your King James says, according to knowledge. And that's a good translation. Get to know her. Study your wife. How many in this room have been married over 50 years? Have we got anybody in the room over married over 50 years? How about married over 40 years? Okay. Do you understand some things about your wife now that you didn't when you first got married? Sure. Do you understand some things about your wife now that you didn't 20 years ago? I'm getting some head nods. You know, we need to study our wives. Most of us in this room love to study something. We'll study politics. We'll study the stocks. We'll study sports. We can rattle off all kinds of statistics and what quarterback did well and wish the Chiefs would finally get a good quarterback and on and on and on. We know all the details about a whole host of things, but we can live a life almost oblivious to the ins and outs of this one we married, of this one for whom we proclaimed our love. When she cries, why does she cry? When she's happy, why is she happy? And what kind of responses of mine to that does she seem to appreciate, and which ones does she not, and why? It's taken me 15 years, but there's one quality of Amber's I am finally beginning to appreciate and respond to. It sure would have helped if I'd learned it about 15 years ago. But I'm finally beginning to learn it now, and it does help. He says here, live with her according to knowledge and give honor to her as to what? A weaker vessel. I've heard an individual try to explain that away. Well, you see, John, weaker vessels are precious vessels. You know, they're like your china or whatever. And what he's saying here is you should treat her as you would something that's valuable. Well, that is true. But I think there's more here to it than that. And I think any man who's lived with a wife with open eyes can see this. Both man and woman are vessels, but God has made the woman the weaker vessel. Not necessarily intellectually, certainly not morally, but he has made her weaker constitutionally, physically. She is more vulnerable emotionally. As Albert Barnes put it so many years ago, she's left it less adapted to the rough and stormy scenes of life. And that's why God gives her a big, strong man like you, giving honor to her as to the weaker vessel. Tom Woody said to me years ago, and I don't remember what we were talking about exactly, but he said, you know, what we sometimes want women to behave like men. Now, we don't really want that, but that's sometimes what we want. Just toughen up. Why do you have to make such a big deal about this? Can't you get over that? And what we're wanting to do, what we're doing is we're wanting a woman to behave like us. Well, she's not a man, and she's going to behave differently. We need to give honor to that. And I know I'm saying the obvious in so many cases, but maybe it's not the obvious to some of us. Dr. Willard Harley, H-A-R-L-E-Y, wrote a book entitled His Needs, Her Needs. I'm not going to recommend that book wholesale by any stretch of the imagination, but he has some interesting things to say in the book. Through counseling of couples, he has developed 10 categories of what he calls emotional needs. He says that if these needs are met, there are 5 of them for men, 5 of them for women. 5 major emotional needs that men want met, so-called needs. They're not needs in the fullest sense, but desires, wants. 5 for women, 5 for men. And that if these are met, marriages are much more affair-proof. And, of course, he speaks from a secular worldview. It is interesting to consider the 5 that he says are women's top 5 quote-unquote, needs. And I'm going to go ahead and write those up here on the board. And then depending upon, I think we're going to take time with 5 others from a different source. But he says from his counseling experience and from his observation, a woman's number one, quote-unquote, need from her husband is affection. Now, affection can, of course, take many forms, verbal, physical, and so forth. But this is her number one, quote-unquote, need. He says to most women, affection symbolizes security, protection, comfort, and approval. Hear those words, comfort and approval. Think of how important those things are to your wife. Showing her affection says, I'll take care of you. I will protect you. It says to her, I am concerned about the problems you face. I'm with you. It says, I think you've done a good job, and I'm proud of you. Sorts of things that can be very important to a woman. He writes, quote, men need to understand how strongly women need these affirmations. For the typical wife, there can hardly be enough of them. Hugs, kisses, cards, flowers, dinners out, opening the car door, holding hands, walks after dinner. The sorts of things you did when you were dating and more. Back rubs, phone calls, etc. There are 1,000 ways to say I love you. And I will submit here, it's extremely important that you tell her that you love her. Now, I realize every woman may be different and every person is different, but I've heard it said, and I believe it, that it is almost the lifeblood for some women. If they are not told repeatedly and regularly by you, the husband, that I love you, honey, that this really tears them up. And it can really make for some rocky moments in a marriage and build up some bitterness From a woman's point of view, affection is the essential cement of a relationship. May not be the way we're wired, but it's the way she's wired. Number two, he points out that it's very important for a woman that we engage in conversation. I just feel like I'm belaboring the obvious here, but she needs you to talk with her and listen to her. She needs lots of two-way conversation. A lot of this went on before you got married. You used to sit up, if you could, for hours and talk with her before you got married. That mustn't drop off afterwards. You need to take time to talk to her, and by so doing, you'll have an inside track to her heart. It's an important thing. It's very important to a woman that she knows she have your honesty and openness. And we're going to be touching on some of these things again here in just a little while. Honesty and openness. A woman needs to trust her husband totally. And you ask yourself that. Does my wife trust me totally? A sense of security is the common thread woven through all five of a woman's basic needs. And this is a big one. A woman must trust her husband to give her accurate information about his past, about his present, and about the future. If you and I do not maintain open and honest communication with our wives, it will undermine her trust in us, and it will eventually destroy that security which is so important to her. Without trust, she'll feel off balance. She'll grow away from you rather than towards you. It will build huge walls. This is huge for a woman, and it's big for us, but it's different for us. She wants to know that not only you're being honest with her, but you are sharing with her, and you're not hiding from her. I mean, we're all like this. When we start getting the sense that politicians are hiding things from us, we don't believe them. And our wives are the same way. Financial commitment. This is part of her sense of security as well. She needs to know that you're going to take care of her and that she doesn't have to depend on herself. The modern American woman is independent. She doesn't need a man. Well, God didn't make us to live without women, and He didn't make women to live without men. And He has made man to be the provider. We're physically more capable of it. And she needs to know that she doesn't have to depend on herself. He writes the following, quote, "No matter how successful a career a woman might have, she usually wants her husband to earn enough money to allow her to feel supported and to feel cared for," which is interesting. She wants to know she doesn't have to depend on herself. Finally, one other thing that's very important for a woman is family commitment. I'm going to open the floor here in a moment to see if you have anything you'd like to offer or give some of us young men advice. A wife wants her husband to be a good father. She wants him to be committed to the family. A vast majority of women who get married have a powerful instinct to create a home and to have children. We see women who enter the career world, and then what happens? They get in their mid-30s, and they start feeling that maternal instinct, and they want to get out and start having children. A vast majority of women have a very powerful instinct in this direction, and they want to know that you have an interest in those children. They furthermore want to see your leadership in the lives of those children. Committing yourselves to their moral education, to their educational development in a secular academic sense, they want to know that you have an interest in your offspring and you're willing to commit time to them. These five things, says Willard Harley, are the five things that when he has counseled people, when one of these things is not met, it makes the relationship much more vulnerable to trouble from the outside. Now, that may not be the concern in your home. What's our concern here is that we love our wives. And here are five things we can do to help ensure that we're doing that. Now, I'm just going to open the floor. Was there anything any of you wanted to add?
On that affection, as faith without works is dead, yeah. Tell her you love her all day long, but if you don't
amen.
If you don't demonstrate, the words become
yes. Absolutely. Calvin.
Just looking at your list up there, if you had it, the word in the middle, honesty, almost could go above all of the others. It must be honest affection.
Oh,
honest,
yes. Good point.
It must start with, just as anything else starts with truth.
Yes. Thank you. And love rejoices in the truth. Absolutely. Yeah, thank you. Thank you. It's got to be based in truth. Was there another comment? All right. Well, I'm going to run a little bit of a risk and turn our attention to five other qualities, and I'm going to put them over here on the right side. A breakdown of a man, but I think a pretty good one. It's been a while since I myself have visited these things carefully, and I'd like to visit them with you today, and I know it's going to be a revisit for some of you. Can I see a show of hands of how many of you have read the book, The Five Love Languages? All right. How many of you have heard of the book, The Five Love Languages? All right. Well, there's some of you who haven't, so maybe, or at least you're not willing to tell me you have. So maybe this can be of benefit to you. Gary Chapman, I don't know his story, but he wrote this book a number of years ago, and it was pretty popular there for a while. I don't know just how popular it is right now, but he points out that from his observation, and I think it's true, that we all tend to love in different ways. That there are five, what he calls love languages, five different ways in which most of us express love and like to receive love. And that within those five, there's generally one that you favor more than any of the others. There'll be one or two, but one more than any other that you favor. And often the one you favor, in other words, the one in which you like to receive love, will not be the one that your wife favors. Opposites attract. And so what can happen in a marriage, and I agree with what Richard Garvey told me several years ago about this. He was in a group where they were studying this book, and he thought the book was just unnecessary. He said, you know, if you love your wife, you're not going to need this. I think he may have said something like, if you're paying attention and showing concern for her, you're not going to have trouble with this. And I think that's probably true in many cases. But some of us maybe aren't very observant. If you are... You know that when someone does such and such to you, it makes you feel up. So I'm going to do this for her, but that's not her love language, says Gary Chapman. She'll appreciate what you're doing, but it will leave her with a little bit of an empty love tank, if you will, because the way that's most important to her will not be met. And I do, again, think there's truth in this, and I'm just going to write these up here, and we're going to talk about them a little bit, and you can see if you think there's any truth in it or not. The first, he says, of these so-called love languages is words of affirmation. Words of affirmation. Mark Twain said that I could live, he said, quote, I can live for 2 months on a good compliment. And I think there are a lot of us who are like that. I'm someone who takes to heart what people say, for better or for worse. But a compliment can go a long way with me, so can a criticism, and I think that's true of most people. Proverbs 18:21 says, death and life are in the power of the tongue. Proverbs 12:25 says, anxiety in the heart of man causes depression, but a good word makes it glad. The Bible repeatedly emphasizes to us the power of the tongue. And here he says, some people feel the most loved when they receive these things, these words of affirmation. Let me give you some examples. I really appreciate you washing the dishes tonight. Thanks for supper. I want you to know you work hard at this every day. I don't take it for granted. You know, I see that God created me to need a helpmeet. Thank you for being mine. You are such a blessing in my life. I thank God for you. Thanks for putting up with me. What would our family do without you? And a million variations on a theme. Ask yourself, how many words like this have you shared with your wife just in the past week? Have there even been any? For some women, this is huge. You might be going out of your way to do all sorts of things for her, but if you're not speaking to her, your concern and care and appreciation for her, she may be feeling very empty. Look for opportunities to do this sort of thing. And know that there are a number of ways you can do it. If you don't feel like you want to say it, or maybe you want to add to it, I was going through my office a couple of weeks ago. I'm trying to clean it out. I'm giving Kevin to deliver to Jared Eggleston 9 books today. It's nice to get them out of my office. I got lots of things in there, and I've been going through them, and I came across a number of notes and letters that Amber has written to me at various times down through the years. And I find myself saving these things. You know, they're over here, and there's this little pile, and I read them, and they spark sometimes shame in me for how I have failed to be what I'm supposed to be. And they remind me of how wonderful her love has been. And notes like that can be very inspiring. You know, maybe for your wife, as you're leaving for work one morning, just stick a post-it note on the mirror and in the bathroom and take off. When she gets up in the morning and she sees it, put a little post-it note in the kitchen drawer. Or a little card. It may go huge. You may come home to a different woman than you left that morning. If you tell her how much you appreciate her, encouraging words, furthermore, they inspire and they serve as the catalyst sometimes for great change in our wives. Now, that's not a reason to do them, but it's one positive result. You start telling her how much you appreciate her. And what do we tend to do when people genuinely appreciate us? How do we tend to respond to them? Favorably, yes, but we tend to want to continue to act to get that appreciation, do we not? Our wives are no different. We're no different. Verbal compliments are far greater motivators than nagging words. I ran track in high school. I wasn't very good, but I ran it. And I remember one year, I had a fellow track runner who was much better than I was. I think he was running the 800. I don't know if it was in a relay or an individual race, but he was running the 800. And if any of you who know anything about track, the 800 is two laps around the track, and that last half lap is a killer. Because that's when your body's just crying out, "Can I please stop?" And that's when you hit the wall. And here he was, I believe, coming around that the first part of the last turn. And I was standing down there. And now somewhere along there in that last half, and I was cheering him on. And I think I may have been saying things like, "You're ahead of him, stay ahead of him." He told me later, he said that that had made the difference for him in that race. Now, that's just a simple illustration of the fact that positive, encouraging words go much further. When you see something that you don't like in your wife, what's your tendency to do? Well, okay. And we're going to fix it by telling her how she needs to fix it. Well, there can be a place for that as long as it's dove and gentleness and love. But, man, for every one of those, let's have about 10 or 15 of these others. And I know it's easier said than done. And it takes effort. It takes effort. This is not natural for some of us. There are a few people who by nature may be encouragers. Barnabas may have been one of them. But most of us, some of us, particularly in our family, need to make genuine efforts. You know, I have known a man, and I myself have been this way, where I can be a great encourager to that young man at church. I can come up and really encourage certain people, but then go home and never do that for anybody there, hardly. It's wrong. I need to look for opportunities to tell my wife how much I appreciate her, what good she's doing for our home, what a treasure she is to me. And she's far more likely to reciprocate with something I desire, having been the recipient of such words, kind words. This has to do not only with what is said, but the way things are said. Matthew chapter 10, verse 19. Let's take a look at that for just a moment. Matthew chapter 10, verse 19. It's interesting to notice what Jesus says to the apostles here. Matthew 10, 19. "But when they deliver you up, do not worry about what?" What does he say? Do not worry about what? That's not all he says. How, or what you should say. Do all of your Bibles say that? Do not worry about how or what you should say. You know, maybe that's not exactly what Jesus is getting at there, but there is truth that you can say the right words and you can say them in the wrong way. And sometimes you can be sincere, perhaps, and still say them in the wrong way. You know, I studied communications in college, which is a big fancy word for putting academic labels on the obvious sometimes. But I remember one thing we talked about and how it, with respect to our nonverbals, the cues we give when we're talking, our gestures and our posture and so on. When someone is talking to you and they're speaking words to you, and those words are very concise and they're not ambiguous, they mean a certain thing. But if their nonverbal cues, if their gestures and so forth don't seem to match up with their words, even though gestures are much more ambiguous, which do you tend to trust? You trust their nonverbals. You go home, "I don't know, that guy leaves me uneasy. I know he said that, but..." It's interesting. We trust nonverbals. So it is important, not that we're not faking things here, but that we make sure that our demeanor and the tone of our voice and the way we are looking at her reflect what we really mean. And we don't give it just short shrift. The way we say it matters. Now, consider even speaking well of your wife to others. Just speak well of her, to her and of her. Any comments on that first one? All right, let's go to the second one. Quality time. Quality time. Now, this is not about just being together It's about being together with her and giving her your undivided attention. When I'm giving, if I'm spending quality time with my wife, we're not watching television. And this is not a commentary on television. It's just that when we're watching television, we're watching television. We're not watching each other. Quality time means we're giving each other undivided attention. There's not something else that is taking that from her. Things like going for a walk, going out for dinner, sitting in the living room together and talking, sitting alone at the dinner table after the kids have taken off and are playing upstairs or whatever, and just sitting there and visiting with her a while before it's time to clear the table, laying there in bed with her at night, just talking before you both fall asleep. Quality time where it's clear to her that I'm focused on her. If I give my wife 30 minutes of my undivided attention, I am giving her 30 minutes of my life. And for some, that is a powerful communicator of love. And Gary Chapman breaks this up into dialects, and you know, some of this can get a little contrived, but I'll go ahead and share with you what he says. He says there are three dialects, at least, to this quality time, and the first of them being what he calls togetherness. Togetherness, not being about proximity, not being about how close you are, but again, being together in your focus. You know, when a father's sitting there with his child, you know, I've sat in the living room and played with my children on a whole host of levels and in all kinds of ways. And I'm sitting there in the living room, perhaps, and I'm rolling a ball back and forth with my daughter or my son. Now, and I'm not doing anything else. I'm just sitting there on the floor, rolling a ball back and forth with my daughter or my son. What's going on there? Well, you're rolling a ball back and forth. Well, yeah, but not really. What's going on there is I'm saying to this child, I care about you. I'm bonding. I want to spend time with you. I love you. That's what it's saying. And my wife's not a child. Your wife's not a child. But she responds similarly. When you take time, and it may not even be a huge amount of time, but there needs to be time taken out of your life where you devote solely to her. Oh, that speaks powerful. Togetherness. Also, he says another dialect is quality conversation. Quality conversation. And, I like to talk. Well, yeah. But quality conversation isn't about talking so much as it is about listening. It is about listening. Drawing her out and listening to her. James 1:19, what's James say? Be swift to hear and slow to speak. Swift to hear, slow to speak. I remember my dad giving me that advice when I was a teenager, maybe taking off to go be with some friends. Swift to hear, slow to speak. Swift to hear, slow to speak. Are your conversations with your wife like that? I don't even have conversations with my wife. Or when I do, I'm telling her about something. How much time do you spend listening to your wife? Asking her questions, drawing her out so that she can share with you the things that are important to her. Maintaining eye contact with her. Not listening to something else or doing anything else at the same time. And, you know, women are a lot better at that than we are. I'm not really all that great at multitasking. Amber and I are quite a combination. We've got 6 children in this house, and neither one of us is particularly good at multitasking. And it's kind of difficult for us, admittedly, sometimes. I need to give her undivided attention and undivided listening attention. And some of this, I think there's truth in this. I need to be listening not only for what she's saying, but what's behind what she's saying. Women are very emotional creatures. We have emotions as well, but I don't think we're governed by them as much as our wives are. They're very emotional creatures. And we need to listen to what's behind the words. And I think it can be appropriate for us to ask questions after they've been talking and ask, so is this how you're feeling? And you spell it out. And when you do that, what have you just done? You've said, I've been listening, number one. And you've said, number two, if you're right, which is great, I get it. And I get you. Very important to a woman. Observe her body language. And refuse when you are talking, and this is true of all conversation, but refuse to interrupt her. Research shows that the average person listens only 17 seconds before interjecting his own ideas. That's not very good odds. 17 seconds. We can't say a whole lot in 17 seconds. I remember Kyle Stevens and I were sitting at the same dinner table one night. We were visiting with some people. And there was one individual at the table who liked to talk. And he observed her bottom lip just trembling, just waiting to get the next word in. She liked to talk. She liked to talk a lot. And as far as she was concerned, every statement someone else made was a request for her to talk some more. That's how it seems to be. And we don't want to be that kind of person. My goal in speaking with my wife, and you know, some of these quality conversations, what are they going to turn into? They're going to turn into me maybe hearing some things I don't want to hear. My goal is to understand. It is not to defend myself. It's not to correct her. And it's not to compete with her. One of the other benefits of that communication stuff I studied, I found it interesting. In the 1970s, a woman by the name of Deborah Tannen, T-A-N-N-E-N, put out a theory or put out something she called gender-left styles. If you need to find this sort of thing interesting, you can Google that if you have any more interest in it. And what she did is she studied the communication styles of men and women. Now, this is a woman, mind you, 1970s. Feminism's, you know, on the rise. But she observed that in general, men and women communicate very differently. And so she called them dialects or genderlects within the same language. And for example, she said that when men communicate, often they do so for report, as she put it. In other words, they are just conveying information. Whereas women often, when they are talking for rapport. Yes, they're interested in conveying information, but one of their goals also is to establish a connection and a relationship. Women spend much more time doing what are called back channels. Yes, okay. And when you're talking to a woman, you may want to bear that in mind. By just little words like here and there, you're affirming to her that you're listening. Men may not like that. That's interrupting us. But a woman can appreciate that. Yes, okay, I understand as you're going along. Also, men tend to talk for status. Men, let's be honest, when we're sitting around together and we start talking about hunting stories or we start talking about fishing stories, all right, this guy caught this fish and then this guy caught a bigger one. And if this guy caught a fish, you know, let's say I'm not a fisherman. He catches a 6-pound bass? That's a pretty big bass. Maybe not so big. 6-pound bass, all right? If you haven't caught one bigger, do you share your story? No. Why not? Because he just won. Men tend to communicate for status, whereas women communicate for connection. You know, I mean, if you've been married any time at all, you know how ridiculous this is. But, you know, you're driving down the street or driving down the road and your wife sees something over the side of the road that she thinks is, you know, neat or impressive. Oh, look at that. And the man's gut reaction is, oh, that's nothing. You should have seen thus and so. And, you know, if it was among two guys, it might seem nothing. But with her, it can be a big deal because that's not why she said it. Just little things like that. Refuse to interrupt her. Listen, you're not there to compete or any of that other stuff. You're just there to make a connection with her and tell her that you appreciate her. And I do think it is important for some men to learn to engage in self-disclosure. Self-disclosure is absolutely essential to relationship building. You show me a deep friendship you have, and I'll show you if we could trace it back a time when you revealed something personal to that person for the first time. That's what allowed that relationship to begin building. That is, by the way, what starts affairs. When you're working with that lady, or she's working with that man, and for some reason one day the conversation goes beyond business, and he or she plunges into something personal. And then the other person responds and suddenly an emotional connection begins to develop. Self-disclosure is where connections are made. And some individuals have a hard time with self-disclosure, partly because of the way they were raised. You grew up in a home, perhaps, where to request a toy was to get a lecture on how the fact we don't have money or how you shouldn't be consumed with pleasure. To show anger was to receive harsh, condemning words or anger in return. To show disappointment to your parents was to be made to feel guilty. And so you learn, hey, I don't reveal myself. I just keep it to myself. But that's not going to work in your marriage, especially from the male standpoint towards the woman. Men are probably more likely to do that, and women are most desperate to need or most in need of your self-expression. Learn to open up a little bit. Choose a few things that you can share with her to open up the gates. And the third dialect he puts under this love language is quality activities. Some of this is a little contrived, but it's true. Find time and spending quality time with her to do things that you both like or that she likes. I don't like craft shows. You maybe aren't too big about going to the symphony or whatever it might be. But you know there's something that your wife loves to do. Have you ever done it with her? Maybe she asked one, two, three times, and finally she gave up. And she just goes with her lady friends all the time. Blow her away by saying, honey, when's the next A, B, and C? Let her know that, well, no, I'm not super interested in it, but I do care about you, and maybe you could show me some of what's so interesting to you. Maybe you could share with this part of yourself with me. He cares about me, actions like that say. He was willing to do something with me that I enjoy, and he did it with a positive attitude. I mean, don't go with her and then complain the whole time while you're there. But go with her and let her know that you were glad to have had that experience with her. You wouldn't have done it by yourself, but you were glad to have done it with her. And one of the things, by the way, of activities like that is it gives us memories. Memories. When you get together with an old friend that you haven't seen for a while, what do? You sit around and talk about the things you did. You sit around and laugh about the things that were said and all that. And those memories are very valuable. And they make for a beautiful relationship and for that relationship to continue. Same way here. By doing things with your wife, you have things to talk about in the future. Good memories to share with each other. Now, I don't want to impose this. I don't know if Dale's in here. Dale, we had a break last year. Are you wanting to have one this year? Or Bill, are you wanting to have one this year? We just want us to go on. All right. All of this, things like this, it's going to be telling your wife that you do love her. And the pleasure of living with a wife who feels loved will be worth it. If you don't have a loving relationship with your wife right now, keep in mind that if you'll make the kind of changes we're studying before talking about right now, life's going to get real good. The love of a woman can just hardly be beat. The love of God's the only thing that beats it. But if you're not getting it right now, 99 out of 100 times, it's because you're not giving what you ought to give. Neil? All right. So for the sake of the recording, Neil shares with us that he thinks this love language of quality time is one of the easiest to identify, and how that it can make a huge difference in a child even in 15 minutes, and how it changes over time. How it might be an activity when they're small, but it might be conversation when they're older. I hope that was a fair encapsulation of what you said. Let's move on to the third one. Receiving gifts. That last word is gifts, if you can't see it. Receiving gifts. Seems like God made us to be gift givers and gift receivers. Gary Chapman says he studied cultural patterns surrounding love and marriage. He went to Central America and studied cultures of the Aztecs and Mayans. He crossed the Pacific, studied the tribal peoples of Melanesia and Polynesia. He has studied the Eskimos. He studied the Aboriginal Ainus of Japan. I myself have been over to Ghana in West Africa. And in these cultures, gift giving plays an important role, just like it does in our own lives and in our own culture. What does the proverbial little child do when it goes outside? Picks a flower. Brings it in to mom. Who taught that child to do that? I just wonder if you could create an environment where you never brought up anything like that to a child, if once they hit a certain age, they would do it. I just wonder if there's something instinctual here, something built in, bringing something. My oldest girl, well, maybe most of my children. I mean, I have a stack. I've mentioned this before, but I just have a stack of drawings and things that my kids have given me. And I've thrown some of them away. I mean, it's just huge. I'm constantly being given stuff. What's causing them to do that? There is a desire to give to one who they value. Have you given a thing to your wife, let's say in the past month? Well, you're saying I need to be spending money all the time? No, I'm not saying that at all. But a gift is something that I can give to my wife, which she can look at when I'm not around. And what does it say to her? It says, he values me. He was thinking of me. And it doesn't have to be fancy, and it doesn't have to be expensive. I think it may have been Eldon Cox, Eldon and Muriel Cox. Some of you may know them. I think perhaps I heard of him putting together a bouquet for her made of flowers he picked off, like off the side of the road or something. Was it Eleanor Roosevelt made sure we've got flowers on the side of the road? So he gathered up and made these for her, and here's this, you know, bouquet or whatever. And he didn't spend a dime for it. But it says something to her. Things like this say to my wife, I was thinking about you when you weren't around, and very little could make her happier than that. We hear at weddings, these rings are an outward sign of an inward and spiritual bond, or things like that. And it's true. There are women who never want to take their ring off their finger. Why is that? Because it represents something to them. It represents a commitment. It represents a bond they have. And a gift you give them will say the same thing. And this is, and this is an easy language to learn, at least theoretically. It's not complicated. It means you go and you make or buy or get something and you give it to her. But what's one of the big hitches for this, for some men?
Spending the money.
Now, for some of us, this is not an issue. It's not always the woman who's the spender in the household. There are families where the man is more inclined to spend money than the woman. I'll confess to you, I am the head of such a household. My wife is much better naturally with that sort of thing than I am. But if you are the kind of man who doesn't like to spend money, let me encourage you to give it a little bit of thought. We're not asking you to spend huge amounts of money, but you do need to spend money in harmony with where you are financially. If the millionaire is giving his wife lots of $1 gifts, she may begin to wonder. But it is possible for your $1 gift to say $1 million worth of love. It largely depends on where you are. And for those of you who want to feel like you're getting something back on your money, you're getting something back on your money. Let me ask, which would you rather have? Better is a dinner of herbs where love is than a fatted calf with strife and hatred, however that verse ends. Better is a relationship where my wife is happy and looking at me with loving and adoring eyes than a bank account that's got, an extra 100 in it? Extra 200 in it? I mean, what do you want? Do you want to have an extra couch when you're retired or a happy wife? It's a no-brainer. It's a no-brainer, but we don't think long-term sometimes. She's going to appreciate when you bring that gift home. And it doesn't have to be something fancy. Again, maybe you just buying a pizza and bringing it home so she doesn't have to make dinner that night. Maybe while you're at work, going ahead and calling and having him deliver a single rose to the house. You're not doing it every day, but on a regular basis, you're doing it. I admittedly don't know what I'd do if I felt like this was my wife's love language. It would be hard. I find it difficult. I have found it difficult in time past to buy gifts. But if I ever am convinced that that's her love language, I need to do that. And I hope that you will do the same. Let's go to the fourth one. Yes.
Before you go to the fourth one, I'd like to just briefly comment on this.
Please.
It's called what?
Preventative maintenance.
And I'll give you a simple illustration. You walk into the grocery store, spend $5 on a bouquet. Versus the same flower you call to have delivered, it's a minimum of $25 because it's waste money. They're required to be delivered in a vase.
Oh.
Well, I don't need a household full of vases.
Okay.
So I'll save it very home myself and I spend $5.
All right.
Preventative maintenance.
Very good. Thank you. Anything else? That was the voice of experience. Acts of service. Acts of service. Doing things for your wife that you know she would like for you to do. Fixing the front door. Fixing the deck. Taking your child on that dental appointment. Mowing the yard. Cooking a meal. Vacuuming. Helping pick up the living room, taking out the trash, keeping the car in operating condition, reading Relationship Rescue, whatever it might be. Doing the thing that she so wants you to do. Jesus came to serve, and you, as the husband of your wife, need to serve as well. And like I said with words of affirmation, you're going to need to make a special effort to do this. Special efforts are in harmony with the nature of love. Love goes out of its way. It's sacrificial, as we've heard. So ask your wife, if you don't already know, what can I do for you? Come home today, perhaps, if you realize that this is the thing that resonates with her, and say, is there something I can do for you today? Or is there a task that needs to be done that I can get on for you this week? See what she says. Three important observations when it comes to acts of service, or a couple rather. Number one, you did things like this before you got married to her. You were willing to do whatever it took. If she had a desire, you got on it. If she had something she wanted and you could provide it, you got on it. But sometimes when we get married, those things start to disappear after the love experience dissipates. Let me ask you, why is it that we behave the way we do within our marriages once we get comfortable with them? I mean, we start out and we're on fire, you know, and we're doing all these good things while we're dating and courting or whatever. And we maybe do it for, you know, first month, 6 months, year of our marriage. But then we settle into this different pattern where we're not doing these things. What is it that ultimately leads us to that point? Maybe you don't have that. Maybe your marriage is just magnificent and you've never made these sorts of mistakes. But when we do make mistakes in our marriage, consistent ones, habitual ones, what gets us to that point? Kevin? All right. Kevin says taking it for granted. Absolutely. Neil? Ah. Your failure to be a husband, only she knows, no one else knows. Is that what you mean? Of course God does, but no one's there to tap you on the shoulder and say, hey, shape up. All right. Yes. Joseph. All right. Your priorities are mixed up. You're not valuing her, not valuing your obligations before God. Sometimes I wonder also if it has to do simply with the patterning we came into our marriage with. How many of us here have had the experience of looking at the way we are treating our wife or raising our kids and suddenly realizing this is just like Dad? Maybe Dad had a wife, your mother, who didn't receive love in this way. He had figured it out, and you didn't see this sort of thing. So you behave like Dad did. We've got to be careful that we don't let the way our parents work their marriage be the way we work our marriage. One thing it can help with this, too, is if I want to know what's important for my wife, what she wants me to do, sometimes I don't have to ask her. All I have to do is listen to what she complains about. Right? What kind of things is she complaining about right now, if she is? What kind of sorts of things have you found her mentioning to you repeatedly? Maybe she's even nagged you about it, and that's not right, but she has. And it's been about that door, or it's been about a certain thing that she wanted you to look into, and you've left it hanging. Listen to what she's saying and respond accordingly. And let me just say one thing. You know, I don't know how your marriage works, and I don't need to know. But back to this patterning thing, you know, I grew up in a home. I don't know that my dad would really know what to do in a kitchen if he had to. I'm sure he could figure something out, but that's not how my mom and dad's marriage has worked. That's been her world completely, and that's fine. That's how their marriage works. It doesn't work that way in my home. My wife has 6 children, all 12 and under. My mom never had that. My wife homeschools the children, and they're home all day. My mom never had that. My wife lives in a home where there's sometimes all 8 of us are there for extended periods of time all day because my office is in the home. My mom never had that. So I have to be willing to do what works for my home. And that has meant assuming some responsibilities my dad never would have thought of assuming, and my mom probably never would have thought of him assuming, to help along the way. And these are examples of acts of service, possibly. Now, I bring this up because some men may feel like, well, if for me to do some of the things you just described, John, that compromises my machismo. That's not manly. I ask you, who says? Are you a servant of God or are you a servant of your culture? The godly man, the real man, does what his wife needs and what she appreciates. And the manly thing to do might be to go ahead and come home and blow her away by go ahead and pulling out the vacuum cleaner and helping her up with the living room just a little bit. Or doing things that you might feel uncomfortable with at first. Maybe that's not an issue in your home. Maybe that won't help, but I think it can. And quite frankly, One of men's frequent frustrations is how things are going on in the bedroom. And a woman is enticed and interested in you based on what you do in almost every room but the bedroom. One woman even said something like, him coming home and washing the dishes or vacuuming makes me 80% more likely to have an encounter with him that night. It makes a difference to a woman if you will step into the fray and do things for her that are important to her and maybe she can't get done right now. We're going to do one final thing. Physical touch. Physical touch. Babies who are held, hugged, and kissed develop a healthier emotional life than those who do not receive such attention for long periods of time. I know a man in the churches who has struggled with homosexuality. And if I'm remembering this right, he tells me how that when he was very young, his father died before he remembers. And his mom had a tremendous amount of anger and bitterness in her heart about maybe that and other things. And I don't know where he got his information, but if I'm remembering right again, she for a time even just laid him down and wouldn't even touch him. Wouldn't have anything to do with him. And he told me, he sees, he's insightful. He says, if you want to raise a monster, just do something like that. And he has said to me, as odd as this may sound to those of us in this room, with respect to the struggle he's had with homosexuality, he says, I just want to be touched. You think, oh, that sounds kind of weird. Well, he had a weird upbringing. Physical touch is very important to us. We may not understand just how important it is because many of us have maybe never gone without it like a man like that has. For some people, and your wife may be one of them, physical touch can make or break the relationship. It has the capacity not only to communicate love, but if you don't do it, to communicate disgust or hatred. With it, they feel secure. They feel connected. Without it, they feel insecure and very disconnected. And we're not talking about, state the obvious here, but we're not just talking about sex. A man who has a great desire for sex with his wife may not even be his primary love language. These two are not necessarily synonymous. Think of all the different kind of touches that you can experience and give. God has made this vessel with receptors all over it. And interestingly, He has not evenly distributed them all. My fingertips are much more sensitive than are my palms. My tongue is much more sensitive than are my shoulders. Different parts of my body experience touch in very different ways, and therefore, every touch is not the same. But touch does play a powerful role. Some touches may demand my full attention, giving my wife a back rub. Some touches less so, putting my hand on her shoulder, brushing against her as I pass by her in the kitchen, holding her hand while we say a prayer. But all of these things, especially to the woman who receives love in this way, saying, I care about you, I love you, you're important to me. And let her be the teacher about what kind of touches she wants. It may surprise you what you learn as you engage in your relationship with her down through the years. But the body is for touching. Someone said the following. Whatever there is of me resides in my body. My spirit and soul are in my body. To touch my body is to touch me. To withdraw from my body is to distance yourself from me. Have you ever had the experience of someone being unwilling to shake your hand? Maybe you haven't. Or maybe someone who you thought you were at odds with, and then they come by and they stretch out their hand. And they do that. And what just happened? What just happened? Suddenly this relationship is different. Maybe not a word was said. Or the word that was said had nothing to do with the previous problem you thought you had with them. But what changed it? A handshake. A touch. So it can be with your wife. If your wife's primary love language is touch, I'll also say that it's especially important perhaps that you be there for her when she is in emotional pain, when she's crying, things of that sort. The best thing you can do for her at that time may be just holding her. Don't try to address the problem. Don't try to get to the heart of the matter. Don't ask a bunch of questions. Just hold her and let her know that you care. Those are Gary Chapman's 5 love languages, and look at them. If you haven't already, which one resonates with you most? And which one do you think most resonates with your wife? And try applying them if you haven't already. Take these 10 and make something of them in the upcoming week. And if your marriage isn't already there, you may learn real quickly just how great a marriage can be. Now, I told you that I had basically two parts, and we're ready to move into the second part, and that is parenting. But before we do that, let me ask you, does anyone have anything closing you want to say about being a loving, godly husband? Yes.
Yeah, my wife recently got to do some of the things that I always do, and she appreciated the fact that I could do those things. I had my fractured my hip 10 weeks ago. I got to really appreciate her taking care of me.
Wow. Yes. Thank you. Thank you. Yes, Bob.
You talked about learning or studying your wife.
Yeah.
And I think I was pretty stubborn. It took me a long time to do that. One little simple thing I learned is, like, in the car and you're listening to the radio and you're driving.
Yes.
She starts to talk. I used to continue to listen to the radio, and then finally I tell her to do it. So I learned that as soon as she starts to talk, just put your shoulder there and shut it off, and it's telling her that okay, I'm going to listen to you.
Yeah.
And that made a world of difference for me.
Cool. Yeah, that's the very sort of thing we're talking about. It's a very simple thing like that. Absolutely. Anything else? Yes.
I just when you talk about acts of service, and I do when my wife got older, she can't do a lot of things that, and I'm back in the force. I didn't used to do that because the fathers are back.
Gotcha.
She can a little bit, but for the most part, I do that kind of thing. And but one time. She was gone for several days preparing for her baptism. And before she came home, I made sure that the place was just as raw cleaned up.
Oh, yeah.
Just, I didn't want her to come home to a messed up house. And she came in and started crying. Because she was expecting.
Yes.
She was expecting something different because she needed to feel like she was needed. My effort, just the opposite.
Oh, interesting. Okay, okay.
She'd come home and found what she expected, she would have been happy.
I see. Wow. Yes, yes. That's a great example of learning. Yes, Joseph.
I experienced something similar to that. If I go about cleaning up a house, then my wife's thankful that I did that. Mm-hmm. And she's planned out her week and knew what she was going to do.
Oh, yes.
And now I've just messed up for a whole week.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, and that's what I've begun to appreciate, that Amber likes to have a plan and likes to have it mapped out, and I tend to want to fly by the seat of my pants. And I've been frustrating her just incessantly for 15 years, and I finally learned. And I've learned to be considerate of that sort of thing. Yes.
I think the example of Christ, where he got on his knees and washed the apostles' feet, God is beneath us.
Amen. Yes. Right. Thank you. No job that's beneath us. Any other comments?
I think you mentioned in that book also that it's important to recognize that there may be a primary language, but there's a secondary.
Yes, yes.
Combine some of those together. You can deliver flowers, and there are words of affirmation like my wife.
Yeah, yeah.
And that'll go along with it. Or there's quality time, do it for someone else. And whatever those things are, combining activities along with one of the other languages, it helps teach your children in a lot of ways to understand being.
Yes, and if you and your wife have not talked about this, by the way, don't be prepared for the possibility, because I've had more than one woman say this to me after hearing this, that she wasn't sure that there was any one of those, and maybe it was just all five. I don't know if I've ever heard a man say that, but I've heard women say that, so... if that's your wife's response, then, find multiple ways to start communicating it to her. But to me, the fact that a woman will say something like that, well, I don't know that there really is one of those, and all those are important, goes back to this thing right here. It's just so very important that a woman be receiving these expressions of love. I think a man can exist more easily without expressions of affection from his wife than a woman can of the other way around. And that's not good, but it's true. We tend to compartmentalize, and I've said these things before, but I mean, we've all got our life kind of in boxes in our house, in the house of our mind. We've got I'm not saying that you're not honest and genuine, but I mean, you've got your church box sometimes, you've got your work box, you've got your hobby box, you've got your room here at home, and when you're at work, you're not thinking about these other things necessarily, and when you're meeting with the brethren, maybe you're not thinking about these other things. And a woman is just much more holistic than that, and she, all the things from each room flow into the main room, they all get muddled up, and if one's filthy, it affects all the others, and we're just not like that. And that's, I think it's one of the weaknesses of men. That's why we need a woman. I've said it before too, but these self-help books and these marriage books, Rick said it last year when some of you were here. He said he had read, given that book, Relationship Rescue, to some of your wives. I don't know if any of you are here, but some of your wives, I think he said something like, they've read it, have you? And it's because they can't live. They're very unease when the relationship is not how it should be. But a man can just kind of shut the door to that part of his life and live without it. He's not where he needs to be, but he'll do it. So we just need to be considerate of that. This is the weaker vessel. She's told to have a quiet spirit. God commands a woman to have a quiet spirit. And I think one of the reasons for that is she may be so tempted to be disquiet because she's at the mercy of a man. And we just need to be considerate of that.